Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes with you on Saturday afternoons here on News Talk 580 KMJ and online at kmjnow.com. Sorry you missed the show last week. We had a football game in the way, but we're in the clear for this week, and I am very excited about the program that we have today. I think you're going to hear a lot of things that you've never heard before. In fact, you'll hear my guest today say that segregation may have saved his life in the military, and that he also appreciated how the military was integrated before the rest of our society was here in the United States. An interesting dichotomy that we'll discuss today with Walter Smith, who's been living in the Valley for the last 40 years, originally from Philadelphia. And I guess that's where you were probably on December 7th, 1941. I start off with so many of the veterans on this program on that date. What do you remember about that day, and how long did it take for the news to get from Honolulu to Pennsylvania?
Well, at that time I was a teenager, of course, and I think a football game was on the radio, and I think it was interrupted, and the news came over and so forth, and of course I was excited like everybody else. I hadn't been following the news that closely, and I didn't know that we were ready to go to war or anything of that nature. But at the time, I got with some of my other teenage friends, and we said, teenage friend.
Of that thing.
of that teenage friend.
Walter Smith remembers from his time in the service. Something tells me you never blew that bugle as the reveille boy, huh?
Oh, of course not. But some way or another, we sort of related to that, at least the guys that I was with and everything. It was an uplifting song, really. And you had to take everything with a grain of salt when you were in the military. And because the military is not a democratic force, So that helped quite a bit.
Now, you were telling us before the break about some of the discrimination that you were faced with as a young soldier in the U.S. Army during World War II. Whether you had a uniform on or not, more people were more concerned with the color of your skin. And the thing that just that I feel inside of me is I can't imagine having that much self-control to put up with some of this stuff and not just go crazy. How did you deal with that ever-present reality without just going ballistic on people?
Well, I think there's always a degree of hope that's involved with the African Americans in this country. And it goes back to the church, too, I think. Lots of us were raised in the church, and we believed that things would get better. And really, they did gradually. But it was a slow process.
Well, and you can speak to that because you stayed in the military until 1969, and we're going to hear more about that. Now, the first outfit that you ended up with, as many black soldiers did in World War II, was what was called an engineer regiment. But it seemed like the duties that you were given, I don't know, you wouldn't say necessarily beneath you, but certainly not what you signed up for.
We thought we were going to be fighters. I mean, that was the thing. I guess that's a macho attitude. And you find out that you're using the shovel and the axe and the pick, and, you know, all that sort of thing, and doing really, just ground digging work.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and a lot of KP.
Yeah.
Now, your officers, so your unit is exclusively black, except for the officers who were predominantly white.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And you told me that you can't prove it, but many of you were convinced one of your officers had been in the Ku Klux Klan.
Yeah. And it wasn't a fact that he tried to hide or anything like that. But I know when we moved to an area where we were doing some work, and there was a lake nearby, and of course, the area was predominantly white. I mean, we figured on our off time, we'd go to the lake and swim. And he forbid us to do that. I mean, the population had nothing to do with that. This was an order from him.
And, just being spiteful.
Yeah. So things like that, you know. Of course, we couldn't go to the lake and swim in the lake that belonged to white people. And so forth.
I imagine that there was a lot of commiserating, or at least you guys would share your stories and your experiences. How much did it help to be in that with other people who were going through the same thing? How much did you draw on each other for strength in a situation that had to be frustrating?
Well, I think a lot of it. We understood what was going on, and I remember, I mean, some guys were very dissatisfied, and one guy decided to desert,
mm-hmm.
and we all knew about it. So when something like that happened, you know, he didn't come back from leave, and so they would investigate, talk to the people in the outfit, and wanted to know where he had gone and what was his thoughts and all that sort of thing. And you just played neutral, that's all.
Mm-hmm. Didn't want to rat him out.
That's right.
Yeah.
But that was his way of dealing with the situation.
What kept you going? What kept you motivated to serve your country when some of your fellow citizens aren't treating you the way that you wanted to be treated?
Because there was always, we always knew that there were people who wanted to help us and do better. I mean, even during slavery time, I mean, the Quakers and so forth and units like that backed us up and helped with the Underground Railroad, as they called it, and so forth. And so we knew that there was always hope.
Mm-hmm.
Things would get better. Things were gradually getting better in certain places. So that's the thing that kept us going.
And you decided at some point you would feel a lot more fulfilled and have a lot more excitement if you got out of that unit that you were in. How did you accomplish that?
Well, at the time, it depended on the president's wife. And so Mrs. Roosevelt was pushing to have black troops in combat outfits. And, of course, she succeeded, and that started with the some of the outfits, like the, I think it was the 99th, and a couple of black regiments, and, of course, the Japanese regiment.
The 442nd, so forth, yeah.
And, but there were just a few, but at least that was showing that there was hope and everything.
Integration was starting
Integration
to begin.
Integration was starting. And it was a fight because lots of people objected to it.
So you, how did you hear about this paratroop unit and decide that that was something you wanted to volunteer for?
Well, because the word came down that they were going to let blacks be in the paratroopers and so forth. And so it wasn't something that they would just announce and say, here, we want you to volunteer. It seemed to be sort of a word that was passed down through the network or something. And once you heard about it, I mean, I went into headquarters and wanted to put in my application and so forth. And, of course, it worked out.
So you ended up with the 555th Parachute Infantry Battalion,
yeah,
otherwise known as the Triple Nickels.
Right.
And you went through the same training at Fort Benning.
Yeah, I went through the same training.
That all the white paratroopers made.
Right.
You hear a lot of times about the 82nd Airborne or the 101st Airborne,
right,
and what they did on D-Day.
Right.
And this is what you thought you would be doing.
Yeah, because we were a part of those units, but we weren't because we were attached, I guess you might say.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, when they decided that they were going to go across, they didn't want to take us.
So they were heading to Europe to get ready,
right,
for Operation Overlord and this massive invasion in June of 1944. And what happened to you guys? And how frustrating was it that you weren't going with
That's
them?
Right. It was very frustrating. And then we found out that we would be assigned to the West Coast Command here as in the West Coast Defense Force, and that meant that they used us for smoke jumping, firefighting, and so forth.
You are the smoke jumpers, the original,
yeah,
smoke jumpers, and you hear that, and people think, well, why in the world would you parachute into a forest fire? What are you doing in that situation?
Well, it wasn't so much going into the fire. I mean, you parachute into the area.
Right. You know, to fight the fire.
To fight the fire.
But I'm sure that wasn't what you had trained for in Georgia.
Oh, no. No, we hadn't trained for that.
Did you have to have new training?
We had a little bit of training on that and so forth. I mean, I don't know how extensive it was. I didn't feel that it was, well, maybe it was the best at that time. I mean, I'm trying to compare it with what you see today, and it was nothing like that.
But it seems to me that it must have been an emotional roller coaster for you, because here you're frustrated in the unit you're in, you think you're getting into something a little more exciting and fulfilling with the paratroopers, and then right as everyone's about to ship out, you get sent to the other side of the country, nowhere near where all the fighting's going on.
That's right.
How did you deal with that?
Well, I guess not too well. I mean, most of us were a little bit discouraged about that. But that was the name of the game, so we played along with it.
Had not much choice, I guess, at that point.
That's right.
We're going to take another break, but when we come back, we're going to find out more about what smoke jumping was all about and what the top secret aspect of this duty for the Triple Nickels, the 555th Parachute Infantry Battalion, was. We're going to hear what Walter Smith did for the duration of World War II and why he decided to continue in the military, serving for the next quarter century in the Air Force from that point on. Walter Smith is our guest today. This is Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you are listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes with you on News Talk 580 KMJ and online at KMJNow.com. Fascinating conversation today with Walter Smith, who experienced the segregation in the U.S. military during World War II, also experienced the integration of the U.S. military through the following quarter century. When we left off, he was talking about smoke jumping in the Pacific Northwest. His paratroop battalion was sent to the Northwest to fight fires. There wasn't a whole lot of information that the public got at this time, but one of the things I've read was that the Japanese actually had hydrogen-filled balloons that were unmanned, but equipped with the right mechanisms to know when to release a sandbag to go up higher that could make it all the way to the West Coast and then drop these incendiary bombs in U.S. forests. I had never heard of that before I read up on the smoke jumpers. Now, you don't know how many of the fires you fought were caused by those bombs or not, but tell us a little bit about what these smoke jumps were like, and did you feel like you were in danger as you're dropping out of this airplane to a smoke-filled forest?
Oh, no. I mean, we knew we were near the fires and so forth. I mean, it was just like one of the fires we went to was up in Montana, I think it was, We knew we were
On that date. What do you remember about that date? How long did it take the news to best for the Smith today, and just trying to soak up some of his story, some of what he went through, and I think the best is yet to come if you're listening at home. So we're going to move on now. He was out of World War II. You heard him tell about his experiences in the U.S. Army, a segregated army during World War II. It's a country where we declare that all men are created equal, but he was not treated equally. And after the war, that's something that you couldn't help but think about. And you stayed in the reserves, so you know there's a chance of another war. There's a chance Uncle Sam can call you back. And you had a little, I won't say you had a conversation with yourself, but you told yourself something. You made a determination of what you would and wouldn't do. Tell me what that was.
I said I would never fight in a segregated outfit, and that was it.
It just hurt you as a person so much.
Right.
And so here along, just 5 years after World War II, here comes the Korean conflict. You're recalled. What's the Army doing with you?
Well, the transition was taking place, but transition in any force is slow.
Mm-hmm. And by transition, you mean President Truman had declared the Army will be integrated.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
And our unit had not reached that stage yet. So we had orders to go overseas.
With an artillery unit.
With an artillery unit.
Mm-hmm.
And it was still going to be segregated. And so I decided, no, I'd promised myself I'd never do that. So I put in for my resignation. And the only way I could do this, having being in the military service, was that I could not go resign with my rank. I have to go into another service.
Now, look, I don't want to slow you down here. To me, it sounds like this took a whole lot of courage for you to do what you did. Is that something that you deliberated over and said, I don't know if I really want to say this, because once I say this, there's no turning back. But what did it take for you to go and say, I won't do this?
It took a lot of thought. Mm-hmm. And it took a lot of soul searching and so forth, because some of the other officers in our black unit, I mean, thought that was ridiculous to give up a lieutenancy.
You were at the time a second lieutenant.
Yeah.
And they told you, if you want to do this, you can go to the Air Force, but you're not a second lieutenant anymore. What? How much rank would you have to give up?
All of it.
All of it.
So I'd go in as an airman.
Mm-hmm.
Which I did. And, of course, I mean, when they realized that I was had been an officer before, I could put in for an officer or a training school.
Right. But I imagine this is not just your pride and your rank. That's probably a pretty big cut in pay, too, isn't it?
Oh,
to go
yeah.
from a second lieutenant to an airman?
Oh, definitely, yeah.
But it meant that much to you.
Right.
To not serve in a segregated unit.
Right.
I think all of our listeners applaud you for that principle that you showed. So take me from there. How did things progress once you got into the Air Force?
Well, after I made officer in the Air Force and everything, I was became a navigator out of the training school and everything. And my first assignment was the old B-29s, which we were still using.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I went over to Korea, flying in the old B-29s.
And you were, I'm pretty sure that almost every one of your missions, you were probably the only black soldier on those flights, right, among that bomber crew?
On my bomber crew, yes.
How were you treated?
I was treated pretty good,
mm-hmm.
I thought. And it all depends on the aircraft commander.
Sure.
And at that particular time, I had an aircraft commander who was very liberal and so forth in his beliefs and things like that. And also we had on the B-29s, you also had enlisted personnel.
Sure.
And I think it was a crew of nine, if I remember correctly. And we had, I was the black officer, and we had one black enlisted man or airman. And it worked out pretty well. In the training program, they wanted to be sure, and I tell people this because people still don't know this, that they weren't sure that black officers could fit in. And they put psychologists, we used to call them squirrel doctors, and they put them in different outfits to monitor how well we operated and so forth. We were still being tested.
Mm-hmm.
And in the training program, the whole crew was involved. And we went through a program in which we pretended like we were shot down and all that sort of thing, and what we would do as a crew and so forth to recover and get to our lines and that sort of thing. And that's where the squirrel doctor was still with us, and he evaluated every one of us, supposedly. And it turned out that our crew came out pretty good. no problems except with one of the enlisted men, one of the airmen, who couldn't get used to the fact that there was a black officer. And so he was taken off our crew.
He was taken off your crew.
He was taken off our crew.
What a far cry from what you experienced in World War II.
Yeah.
Could you feel a difference there? Did that make you feel better about what you were doing and just where the country was by seeing that they were backing you up instead of taking his
side?
Oh,
yes, definitely. There's plenty of progress. And, of course, I mean, that solidified my love for the Air Force, believe me.
Mm-hmm. And I spent so much time talking about how you were being treated and some of the things you were doing, but now you're actually getting to do what you wanted to do. You are
right.
In combat. You're flying bombing missions. Was that exciting for you? What did you enjoy most about it?
Well, it was exciting, but then philosophically, I began to think about the fact that you were killing people.
Mm-hmm.
And that began to get to me in a way. I mean, it's one thing to talk about the glory and fighting and the macho attitude and all that sort of thing. But then when you get right down to it, you're killing your fellow man.
Yep.
And, of course, I begin to feel that. But that becomes a necessity in a way. And I guess the only way you get by that is to say that you think your country has done everything it could to not be in this situation. But once you're in this situation, this was the only thing that you could really do.
Well, and you're doing your job. You're following right. Orders. And I've always been fascinated by how someone deals with that very human side of war, and everyone agrees, war is hell. That's
right.
One of the most apt quotes of all time, I think, and you certainly experienced that in World War II, in Korea, and even in Vietnam, where I understand you were on the refueling planes, right, KC-135?
Yeah, KC-135s, and the combat missions I flew there, what they did to, we were attached to a different outfit, a different unit, the Air Tactical Command, and we would play Mother Hen, as we used to call it. We were a refueling ship, and we would either have anywhere from 3 to 4 fighters that we would take over the combat area, and they would go down and do their bombing and do their shooting and so forth, and then they would come back up.
So you'd just be circling higher up.
We'd be circling in the combat area and so forth, and we would refuel them and so that they could complete their missions and so forth.
Were you ever fired upon?
No. We were... Intelligence showed us or told us where the areas were that there was heavy flak or something like that. The enemy didn't have that much, but sometimes they were pretty accurate. But
so you had the intelligence that steered you clear
right.
From that. Well, we're down to about the last minute of the show here, and I know there are so many more stories from your decades in the military that you'd like to share. One thing I'm curious about, when you retired from the Air Force in 1969, what was your rank?
I'd made major.
Major. Yeah. Did you ever think how much higher you could have been had you stayed in the Army, or do you think that the ceiling in the Army would have kept you down?
No, I could have risen higher because some of the fellows that didn't have my particular philosophy stayed with the Army, and most of them retired as colonels.
Mm-hmm.
So,
something tells me you wouldn't have it any other way than it went, though.
No.
Well, and my hat is off to you. I'm sorry that we're out of time today because I think everyone listening is feeling the same way I am, that hats off to you. Thank you for serving our country. Thank you for having the moral and personal fortitude to do what you have done and to be here to talk about it today. Is there any final thought that you want to share with our audience about why you served our country for so long?
Well, because I believed in what the country was fighting for at the time. And I believe we maybe couldn't have we couldn't have done worse. And we were doing what we thought was right at that particular time. And in the meantime, I take my hat off to the military, because I love the military, really. It wasn't as bad as some people say it was. Most people complained about the food and all that sort of thing. I thought the food was great. I thought the training, when we got training, was great. The only thing you had to really contend with was the fact that it was not a democratic force. It was a military force.
And you learned that lesson full well, for sure. You've shared those stories. Again, thank you so much for sharing those stories with us today, for serving our country, and for making us proud. That's Walter Smith, our guest today. We'll be back next week with another edition of Hometown Heroes here on News Talk 580 KMJ.